Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the Clean Water Act. Over the last 30 years or so, there has been a significant improvement in water quality in the United States, and many people would argue that the federal Clean Water Act deserves much of that credit. At the same time, some environmentalists are concerned that particularly recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court will end up restricting the scope of the act, putting millions of acres of wetlands and something over half of the nation's streams at risk. In this part of the show, we'll be getting an update on the Clean Water Act, and our guest is Joan Mulhern. She is Senior Legislative Counsel with the group Earth Justice. This is a nonprofit public interest law firm interested in protecting the environment. It was founded in 1971 and at that time was called the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and then the name was changed to Earth Justice in 1997. They have provided legal representation to many clients, hundreds of them, including the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Wilderness Society, and also a number of smaller state and community-based environmental organizations. They also were responsible for a survey that we'll be talking about here that takes a look at how people who live in rural areas think about the issue of water pollution and water quality. We'll talk about this in some detail, but just to talk about it a little bit, what they did was they arranged for a survey of people who lived in rural areas in three different congressional districts around the country, one in Tennessee, one in Ohio, and one here in Illinois. In fact, it's the one where I'm sitting right now, the 15th congressional district. And what it is they found was that among these people, very strong support for the idea of protecting water quality, drinking water, the water that people fish in, and the water that they depend on. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. And some other things here this morning in this part of the show. And, of course, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana if you're listening over the air. If you're listening over the Internet in the United States, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Mulhern, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. To begin, I think maybe it would be a good idea just to review a little bit of the history of the Clean Water Act. It's been around now for more than 30 years, and I think that some people would say of all of the environmental legislation that's come along over the past few decades, this is one of the things that people point to as a real success story, that water quality has improved in the United States, and the Clean Water Act, as I said, I think a lot of people think that it deserves a lot of the credit.
That's right. The Congress passed the Clean Water Act by an overwhelming bipartisan margin in 1972. So the law just last October celebrated its 35th birthday. And Congress passed a comprehensive and strong law in 1972 to deal with what was really a national disgrace and disaster. The nation's water quality throughout the beginning and middle of the 20th century had declined precipitously. The nation's waters were routinely used as little more than open sewers and waste dumps for factories and cities. Less than a third of the nation's population were served by sewage treatment plants. So we had cities that were dumping huge quantities of untreated sewage, factories that were dumping pollution into waters. The Great Lakes were in great peril. Oil spills off the coast of California and New England. We had Lake Erie considered to be biologically dead, and a river in Ohio, the Cuyahoga, actually caught on fire. And these issues really grabbed the nation's attention, and the public demanded a strong response. And then Congress did respond and passed the Federal Clean Water Act as a comprehensive national solution to the nation's water pollution problems. The issue had been left up to the states in the 50s and 60s with federal encouragement to act, but by 1972, Congress realized that it needed to pass a federal law that had a strong role for state and local governments, but that provided minimum basic protections against pollution and destruction of our streams, lakes, rivers, wetlands, and other water bodies. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the law has done. In our nation's waters, it's not perfect. Still, 40% of the nation's waters aren't safe for all uses, like recreation or fishing. But even those waters that still have some impairments are much, much better. The vast majority of the nation's population, you know, that has sewage or septic systems to treat their waste. Factories have installed pollution controls. The situation, it is a success story. I think the Clean Water Act is one of the nation's most successful as well as most popular environmental laws.
Mm-hmm. What, generally speaking, what continue to be the main sources of pollution in water?
Well, there are a number of sources. One of the sources of water pollution that the Clean Water Act doesn't deal with as effectively as point sources, as piped sources, is runoff from urban, rural, and agricultural areas, polluted storm water that can carry pollutants from streets and from farms and from other sources into the nation's waters. About 40% of the nation's waters pollution that remains is from these what are called non-point sources. That's because those are generally not well regulated by federal law. There are still, you know, sources of impairment from point sources. The idea of the Clean Water Act is to sort of ratchet down the amount of pollution over time. That's why the permits that facilities that discharge into waters get are only 5 years long, because it's supposed to be technology forcing over time to eventually achieve the goal of eliminating the pollution of the nation's waters. That's mm-hmm. the goal of the Clean Water Act, is to make all waters everywhere safe for fishing, swimming, and other uses. And a key part of the the way that the Congress envisioned that goal would be met is by saying that water pollution needs to be eliminated at its source, which makes sense, right? If you're polluting one part of the watershed, it's going to affect not only that part, but the rest of the watershed as well. And that's why we are concerned, as you said in the introduction, that some of the nation's waters are now at risk of losing that federal protection.
Well, we should talk about that, because this is something that has come up just within the last couple of years, and that it does indeed have to do with the ruling by the Supreme Court, which narrows narrows the scope of the act, because they were looking at this question, well, what kind of water is really covered by this act, and does it indeed extend to virtually any body of water, any little stream, any small wetland, or are we talking about things that are really bigger? And in fact, a key term that's been used by the court as a way of trying to nail this down, well, what's covered and what isn't, is navigable. So what they have done essentially in one recent decision is to say, well, really what we're talking about here is navigable waters. And that would mean that there would be a lot of probably small streams and wetlands that under that, if that was the way you were looking at it, would end up not being covered by the act. And in response, I think some members of Congress have said, no, that wasn't what we had in mind. We can talk about what Congress is going to do in a moment, but mm-hmm. let's talk about, well, what are the consequences of putting this kind of restriction on the waters that are covered by the act?
Well, you've described it absolutely correctly. What happened is that before the 1972 Clean Water Act, Congress mainly only regulated navigation. They didn't have laws in the late 19th and early 20th century to deal with water pollution at the federal level. They did have laws dealing with navigation. When Congress looked at the 1972 Clean Water Act, it kept the term navigable that had been used in earlier statutes, but redefined it for pollution control purposes. And Congress very deliberately redefined the word navigable, which in earlier statutes had meant waters that were susceptible to use or had been used in the past to support commercial navigation, in 1972, Congress decided to keep the word navigable as the basis for federal jurisdiction, but redefined it to say navigable waters means the waters of the United States. And the members of Congress at the time were very, very clear that we mean this term broadly as possible for pollution control purposes. And again, as I alluded to earlier, that purpose was eliminate pollution at its source, wherever the source is in the watershed. So Congress redefined navigable to mean waters of the United States. And for 30 years, the courts really unquestionably, and the federal agencies implementing the law, implemented the law broadly, not to dry land, but to waters, to aquatic features in the ecosystem, like wetlands and intermittent and ephemeral streams, you know, streams that are seasonal, that don't run all year round, but that are where our larger rivers, lakes, and coastal waters begin. The waters that flow into the coastal waters, as well as the lakes and rivers and so on. So for many, many years, this was not questioned. The agencies implemented the law correctly to cover all water sources. And then in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court took up a case out of Illinois called Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County that involved the dispute over whether or not some so-called isolated ponds that were proposed to be filled to create a landfill were or were not waters of the United States. And by a 5-4 split decision, the Supreme Court said, well, we have said in the past, we admit that navigable is a term in the Clean Water Act that doesn't really have the meaning of navigation. But we're now going to sort of breathe life back into that concept and say that even though we've said before it doesn't mean much, we're going to say it doesn't mean nothing. And at least we're going to say that the ponds, these isolated waters that are at issue in this case, are not covered by the Clean Water Act. Boom. So right there, according to the EPA, 20% of the nation's wetlands, 20 million acres, were at risk of losing protection. And actually, we saw examples of, in the ensuing years since 2001, of whole river systems, especially in the West, as well as big ponds in Minnesota and Wisconsin, waters that are actually big enough to float boats, being just declared to be non-jurisdictional by the agencies. Then the situation was made even worse more recently in 2006 in another case that was brought to the Supreme Court, this one from Michigan. The court started to question not just so-called isolated waters, but even whether some small rivers and streams that are tributaries of traditionally navigable waters, whether or not those are protected. And here, in this case, the Supreme Court went all over the map. There was no majority opinion. Four justices said the Clean Water Act covers all waters like we've always said. Four justices said no, the water has to flow relatively permanently. And one justice said, well, I don't believe the relatively permanently, but you probably have to do a little bit more than what's being done now. And I think you need to show some kind of a significant nexus, a significant connection between the upstream waters and the downstream waters so that you're showing that pollution upstream does affect downstream. And so now we have basically a complete disarray under the Clean Water Act. The agencies that implement the law cannot even tell you what is in and what is out. And that's why Congress needs to act. But we can talk a little bit about what waters are at risk in Illinois and nationwide, because we are already seeing the effects of these decisions and agencies ruling that very significant bodies of water now have their federal pollution controls in question at best. And in some cases, agencies just ruling that really large bodies of water are just simply no longer protected at all.
All right. Well, let me just, for the benefit of anyone who has tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I'd like to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Joan Mulhern. She is Senior Legislative Counsel with Earth Justice, and this is an organization that was founded in 1971. Actually, at that time, it was called the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and then in 1997, the name was changed to Earth Justice. This is a nonprofit public interest law firm interested in environmental issues and environmental protection. And we're talking here this morning about water quality and about the Clean Water Act. And as she has said, some of the concerns that have to do with recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court that in effect limits the scope of the Clean Water Act, that some members of Congress would say, we intended this to apply to all water, period. But recent rulings by the court focus on this word that is in the law, this word navigable. What does that mean? If you mean that literally to mean, can you put a not just a canoe, but can you float a large commercial craft, then that would mean that there's a lot of bodies of water, small streams, wetlands that suddenly, some people would say, aren't covered by the Clean Water Act. Questions available. Welcome here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just before we go on to talk about specific bodies of water at risk, I do want to talk just real quickly about the way in which the Congress or some members of Congress would like to address this. There has been legislation introduced, I believe, last summer in the Congress that would essentially, I think the one thing it would do is it would go to the Clean Water Act and it would take out the word navigable. And so it would just leave it as waters, so that then this issue of what is or what is not covered would be addressed, at least in the sense that, this debate of what's covered and what's not would be gone. And at least some members of Congress are saying this is really what we intended in the first place. And we're cleaning up this language so that there will be no doubt as to what bodies of water are covered.
That's exactly right. The legislation is called the Clean Water Restoration Act. And it would do just what you said. It would restore the protections, restore the definition that the Congress had intended in 1972. It would take out the word navigable waters. It would replace it with the term used in 1972, the waters of the United States. And then it adds a specific definition. And so it lays, so there's not a question. It lays out the types of bodies of water that means. So it's clear in the statute. And the definition that it uses is the definition that the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, the two agencies that implement the Federal Clean Water Act, the definition that they've used for many years. The legislation is led by a lot of people from your part of the country. The lead sponsor is from Minnesota, Jim Oberstar, who's mm-hmm. chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. That's the committee in the House that oversees the Clean Water Act. And Congressman Oberstar was actually the chief of staff for the chairman of what was then called the House Public Works Committee when it passed the Clean Water Act in 1972. He sat in on all of the legislative discussions, so he knows firsthand what Congress meant in 1972, as does the other lead sponsor in the House, John Dingell from Michigan, who reported the Clean Water Act for the House. He was a member of Congress in 1972, and he actually made the sort of quintessential floor statement back then about, you know, what I was referring to earlier about, you know, we mean this in the broadest possible sense for pollution control purposes. Those were words out of John Dingell's mouth. So our leaders on this issue can say firsthand what Congress meant in 1972. Also, committee member Vern Ellers, who's a Republican from Michigan, is the lead sponsor with Dingell and Oberstar in the House, and Russ Feingold from Wisconsin is the lead in the Senate. And the bill has strong bipartisan support, especially in the House. There's 173 co-sponsors out of 435 members, so we're getting close to half the House being a co-sponsor of the bill. And we're hoping that both the House and the Senate have already had hearings last year, and we're hoping that both bodies, especially the House, I think we're expecting to move first, will pass the legislation later this winter or early spring.
All right. Well, we have a caller I want to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that rather than make them wait? This is someone who is listening in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm totally sympathetic with the guest today. However, I have to try to explain that environmental law, environmental regulation is intensely political. And what we're seeing now with this Supreme Court, not only in the area of what is a navigable waterway, but also I read a decision today, a reach yesterday, concerning preemption by federal law for dealing with medical devices, preempting state tort law, which has tougher standards. So we have a court, and I think this is going to be President Bush's legacy. We have a court now that is pro-business, that views matters that we thought heretofore were pretty clear, and applies a radical approach in interpreting congressional mandates in a way that is contrary to longstanding interpretations. I hope Congress will reverse these decisions concerning what is a navigable waterway, as I hope Congress will reverse the decision yesterday concerning federal preemption by FDA regulation of medical devices. But as long as the Democrats, especially in the Senate, don't have really a working majority, I'm loath to put any hope that these laws will be corrected by the legislative process. I'd like for you to respond to that.
Well, I completely agree with the caller that some of these issues that have really been matters of longstanding law have more recently become very intensely political. I mean, as I was saying earlier, that's the interpretation of the Clean Water Act, including by the U.S. Supreme Court, had been very consistent for 30 years. There was a case in the mid-'80s called Riverside Bayview Homes versus the U.S., where a unanimous Supreme Court said that, of course, wetlands that are adjacent to open waters, you know, of course, the wetlands aren't navigable, but that they are nonetheless covered by the Clean Water Act. That was unanimous. The judges appointed by Democrats and Republicans all agreed. And it isn't really until more recently that the issue has become more political on the court and on Capitol Hill, frankly. And there are industries that, you know, have been prospering while living with the Clean Water Act for many years that are now trying to get out from under the pollution limits of the law through this device of saying that Congress didn't intend certain waters to be protected. And that's one of the reasons why we did this poll that David alluded to earlier, in order to try to counter some of the misinformation and misperceptions that are being put out there on Capitol Hill and in the media, to try to make it sound like the Clean Water Act didn't ever cover these waters, or that people don't support Congress taking steps to restore clean water and to overturn the court's decision. But I totally agree with the caller that some of these issues, including the role of states in implementing environmental and other laws, which under the Clean Water Act, at least right now, states are free to enact stronger laws. That's explicit in the statute. But those things that have been long accepted are now sort of at risk because of this political environment.
Well, thank you. I agree with you wholeheartedly, even though I hope we can change this in November 2008. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to move on and talk about this survey that your organization, Earth Justice, commissioned. In the Congress, it seems that those people who are raising concerns about this change in the wording of the law and what that would mean, it seems that those people who are most concerned are those people who represent people in rural areas and particularly farmers and ranchers. They're concerned about how this is going to affect their operation and what it will mean in terms of regulation. And I think for some time now, particularly people in agriculture have been concerned about anything that has to do with water and how water is regulated, because they think that affects them very directly. So what you did was you commissioned this poll, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the survey was conducted in three congressional districts that were heavily rural, one in Tennessee, one in Ohio, and Illinois' 15th congressional district, and that's the one in which we are now, in which Champaign-Urbana is included. Wanted to look very specifically at people who lived in rural areas, what they thought about the issue of water quality. And what you found is that in all of these places, significant numbers of people said, yeah, they're concerned about the quality of their drinking water. And they, in fact, believe that the government, it is important, there is an important role of government here for water quality. And in fact, that some of them said that the government had not done enough to try to guarantee the quality of water.
That's exactly right. I mean, the industries, first of all, just back up one step. In Congress, the industries that are primarily funding the effort to stop the Clean Water Restoration Act are the oil and gas industry, pesticide and chemical manufacturers, electric utilities, the mining industry, as well as developers who fill wetlands, the Home Builders Association. But a lot of their rhetoric is trying to hide behind concerns of farmers and ranchers who really are actually largely exempt from the Clean Water Act for normal agricultural and silvicultural activities, and the Clean Water Act doesn't put any new restrictions on them. But it's politically advantageous for those other industries to try to say that this is an issue about agriculture, and they have been saying on the Hill that farmers and people who live in rural agriculturally dependent districts around the country don't support the Federal Clean Water Act and wouldn't support legislation to restore the definition. So Earth Justice commissioned a nationally respected Republican polling firm in D.C. called Bellwether Research and asked them to do these surveys in those three congressional districts that you mentioned. And in each of the districts, the research found that across the board, Republicans, Democrats, Independents strongly said that the government has not gone far enough with laws to protect the environment and keep our water free from pollution by a 2-to-1 margin. In the Illinois 15th, it was 55% who agreed with that statement, the government hasn't gone far enough to keep our water free from pollution, and only 25% who agreed with the statement that the government has gone too far. And that's kind of the way that we did the survey, is to sort of present people with both sides of the question in a way that it's framed by the supporters and the opponents of the act and ask people which view was closer to their view. 59% in the Illinois 15th said that the original intent of the Clean Water Act was to protect all water bodies, not just those that are navigable, and that all streams, wetlands, and other waterways should be protected. Only 26% said that the Clean Water Act should not be expanded to apply to all bodies of water, such as isolated wetlands. Now, of course, we don't think that the Restoration Act expands the Clean Water Act. It restores the definition. But again, sort of trying to use the rhetoric of each side, we asked people which was closer to their view. And again, more than 2-to-1 margin agreed that all the water should be protected. And then I think one of the most significant things about that response was that farmers, people who identified themselves as owning farms or working on a farm, were even more likely. I think in Illinois 15th, the general population was 59% agreed with that statement. Farmers, 63% agreed with that statement. So it's just not proving out to be true that people who farm are concerned that the Clean Water Act covers all bodies of water. They support clean water. I mean, I know most of the farmers that I've worked with in the past, their livelihoods depend on clean water, and they know it. So, and then the final thing that I think is worth noting is that the last question in the survey was, would you be more likely to support a candidate for office who supported legislation to protect all waters at the federal level? And that question across the board was a 3-to-1 margin, that people said they were more likely or much more likely to support a candidate who supported legislation that's like the Restoration Act. And again, that was true across the political spectrum, across all demographics, young and old, and across different areas, whether people identified themselves as a farmer or a fisherman or other demographic questions that were asked. So, you know, we think that this provides a strong counterweight to the claims, the unsubstantiated claims of some groups in Washington that rural voters and farmers individually don't support this kind of legislation.
We have some other callers to talk with. Maybe just real quickly, again, I should introduce the guest. And we're talking in this hour of Focus 580 with Joan Mulhern. She is Senior Legislative Counsel with Earth Justice. It's a nonprofit public interest law firm that's interested in environmental issues. It was founded in 1971 as the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and then in 1997 changed the name to Earth Justice. They provided legal representation to many, many clients, big ones like the National Resources Defense Council and the Wilderness Society, and also smaller state and community-based groups. They do indeed have a website. If you're interested in finding out more about them, it's earthjustice.org. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with someone in Chicago. This is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
First, thanks for the interesting discussion, and I'd like to enter it as well. I wonder if, in fact, what is going on here is quintessentially political, and that, after all, is certainly appropriate enough to a democracy. That is the political shift to a more conservative interpretation of the balance of power between federal government, national government, and the states. In other words, what's largely going on, it seems to me, whether it involves Congress attempting to have open access or passing laws relating to guns in a local school or interpretations of this Clean Water Act, is the question of the powers of Congress to control interstate commerce. So it, to my mind, if I might suggest, whatever Congress does in terms of taking out the word navigation is going to fall flat if indeed we're talking about a fundamental shift or reinterpretation of national government powers in relation to interstate commerce. I wonder if you might comment.
I'm really glad you asked that question. I think it's a great observation. And here's why. You know, back when the Congress passed the 1972 Clean Water Act, a lot of states did object. You know, they said, you know, we'll do the job, as they said in the 50s and 60s, but the problem got so bad, Congress, I think, was compelled to act. There's a very strong role for the states under the Clean Water Act to implement the federal standards and, indeed, even to adopt stronger standards if they wish. But they have to at least comply with the federal minimum standards to ensure that all Americans will get clean water, and there's not an incentive for states to try to lower standards in an effort to attract businesses or things like that. Everyone sort of plays by the same rules unless the states themselves decide to have stronger standards. Over the years, I think the states have come to accept and even embrace the Clean Water Act. And when this Supreme Court decision was pending in 2005, 2006, the decision out of Michigan I referred to earlier, 34 states plus the District of Columbia all wrote a brief on the side of the Bush administration, which my organization, Earth Justice, did as well. And the states in their brief said, we have come to now rely on the Federal Clean Water Act for our state program, and that if you take out the federal floor, you will impede our ability as states to implement clean water protections. Plus, they pointed out that every single one of the 48 continental United States, every single one of those states shares important bodies of water with other states. And so even if the states try to change their own laws to fill the gaps from any loss of Clean Water Act protections, they cannot control all of the waters that come in from other states. So obviously the Great Lakes is a good example. The Montana governor, Governor Schweitzer, testified before Congress this fall that his state, Montana, is the headwater for 17 other states' waters. So there's this interconnectedness that's reflected in the Clean Water Act. So I think actually under the Clean Water Act, maybe the trend is a little bit different than you're suggesting, and actually the states are now lobbying for federal authority that they've come to rely on themselves.
All right. Again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We'll keep going here. We need to get on, and next caller is in Belgium, community not all that far away. That's line number 1 on our line number 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to toss another sack of snakes into this discussion. You've not mentioned word one about subterranean waters. And, you know, we do a lot of strange things with subterranean waters that actually enter into the navigable waterways in some ways also, in that we draw a lot of water from it. But we also do a rather horrible thing of injecting things into aquifers below the ground. Sometimes not intentionally, but sometimes they do end up causing problems. Over here in East Central Illinois for several years, there was a manufacturer of Freon, and his byproducts he injected into the they, not he, it was a very large corporation, injected into the ground at 800-900 feet down. Well, there's aquifers down in that particular area that might interfere with what we do. There doesn't seem to be hardly any laws that deal with subterranean waters in any rational way. Hello?
Yeah, I agree with you. You're correct. And unfortunately, while the Clean Water Act has some programs dealing with study and protection of groundwater, those are very minimal. Most of the Clean Water Act's provisions, especially the provisions against discharging pollutants into water, apply to surface waters and not to subterranean or groundwater. And that is definitely an issue, but that's why I hadn't mentioned it, is because the Clean Water Act primarily deals with surface waters. The Safe Drinking Water Act has some provisions dealing with groundwater sources of drinking water supplies, but as a general matter, groundwaters have been left to states by state, and that's kind of actually sort of getting back to the previous caller and my other point that we've been more effective under the Federal Clean Water Act dealing with surface waters because there has been a federal law and there isn't a companion type law that deals with groundwater. You're correct.
Yeah, it's also dealing with the same thing. Just south of Champaign, where you were having this discussion, was a future gen possibility, and they were going to inject carbon dioxide. Now, that was going to go into rock, but at the same time, it would have some effect on aquifers.
Yes, it would have.
You know, so, and there again, our present administration had some little game they played with that. I can't swear to I know to that for a fact, but sure sounds like it does. They seem to be putting their fingers in all sorts of things that really isn't their bailiwick, isn't it?
Again, I'm not sure how to answer that one. You know, I've been the Bush administration on this issue on the Clean Water Act has kind of been a little schizophrenic. At the Supreme Court, they actually argued the right position that the Clean Water Act covers all waters. But then in the wake of the decision, the EPA and the Army Corps have been issuing some disastrous policies and decisions that have been leaving waters out of the law in a way I think that goes even beyond what the Supreme Court did. So it's sometimes hard to tell where they are on this issue.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. And then we'll go on again. And our next caller is calling on cell phone. They're obviously on the road. And it's line number two. Hello.
Hi, I'm the passenger. I'm not the driver.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
I want to know, has a bill been introduced or is somebody planning to introduce a bill, and who's involved in the bill?
The bill has been introduced in the Senate. The lead sponsor is Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. In the House, it's Congressman Oberstar from Minnesota, Ehlers and Dingell, both from Michigan. The bill in the House has 173 co-sponsors, Republicans and Democrats. There's, I think, one, two, three, four, five, about eight or nine members of the Illinois House delegation who are already co-sponsors of the bill, and along with Senator Durbin and on the Senate side. One of the reasons why we did the polling that we did in Illinois' 15th congressional district is because Congressman Tim Johnson, who represents that district, is a member of the committee that's going to make the decision on this legislation. He's not yet a co-sponsor of the bill, although he has been supportive of clean water issues in the past, and we're really hoping that this poll, as well as input from his constituents, will convince him to get on as a co-sponsor of the bill. People can find out about our poll, about the legislation, and if they wish, even send a note to their member of Congress electronically right from our website, earthjustice.org. If you go and search for clean water or clean water poll, it will bring you right to the place where you can see the full survey results as well as find out more information about the legislation.
Okay. Could I ask one more question? What are the bill numbers in the Senate and the House?
The Senate bill number is S-1870. And the House bill number is H.R. 2421.
2421?
2421, and it's Clean Water Restoration Act.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, again, we have about 10 minutes left in the program. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wanted to make sure that we talked about the Clean Water Act. We talked about this particular issue of the Restoration Act. And something that you mentioned that I do, though, want to get back to is that you said it might be interesting for people to hear about specific waters in the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
That where there is concern, and I guess really again we're going back to this concern about what do we consider to be, what bodies of water do we consider to be covered by the Water Act, and what's the result of this recent narrowing of the focus as to what bodies are going to be regulated and what aren't?
I'm glad you brought us back to that, because I do think it's important for people to realize that this is more than sort of a theoretical or legal battle. It has real-world consequences, and we are seeing them already. One of the categories of waters that, because of the 2006 decision, is most at risk of losing protections are seasonal streams, intermittent and ephemeral streams, those that don't flow all year round, but are nonetheless 59% of the river and stream miles across the country. EPA released some data last year that showed for each state in the country the number of waters, or the percentage of waters in each state that fall into that category of intermittent and ephemeral streams, and then also what some of the consequences are for losing jurisdiction over those waters. Now, in Illinois, according to EPA, 55% of the streams and rivers in the state fall into this intermittent and ephemeral category. Those waters, that 55% of streams in Illinois, serve as the source of drinking water for 1.6 million people in the state of Illinois. So that's, you know, a significant consequence of losing protection. There's almost 100 public water systems. It's actually, the exact number is 91 that EPA have identified. 91 public water systems in Illinois that get at least some of their water from these intermittent and ephemeral streams, and those drinking water supplies serve 1.6 million people. Nationwide, 111 million people get their drinking water from sources that include these surface water streams that are intermittent and ephemeral streams. Another thing in Illinois is that EPA has identified 746 different facilities that have pollution control permits. So this is, you know, factories, sewage treatment municipalities, and so on. 746 facilities that have federally required discharge permits right now under the Clean Water Act. Now, I'm not going to say that all of those, you know, suddenly don't require a permit anymore. Illinois has state laws, because in Illinois, the state issues those permits and has state laws that mirror the federal laws when it comes to discharges from point source of pollution. But other states have laws on the books that prevent them from implementing any standards that are stricter than federal standards. So in those states in particular, we're going to see facilities that have had to limit their effluent from industrial or municipal discharges start to say that they're not subject to the federal pollution control limits anymore. In fact, we've already been seeing a couple of instances, particularly in the more arid Southwest, where wastewater and industrial facilities are saying they no longer believe that they have to comply with the Clean Water Act, because the streams that they discharge into are seasonal in nature. You know, we are seeing, we just had an example a couple of weeks ago where the Army Corps of Engineers declared that a 310-acre lake in Minnesota called Boyer Lake, which is stocked by the Minnesota DNR with walleye and other fish, and obviously 310-acre lake is extremely boatable, that they said that was no longer water of the United States, that it was isolated and not navigable. Now, in that case, the EPA overruled them and said that it was a navigable water and it was under the Clean Water Act. But I use that as an example to show that we're not only talking about, you know, what people are considering to be, you know, smaller and maybe in their minds therefore less important wetlands and streams. Those waters are actually very important often as habitat and to filter drinking water supply and flood control. But we are talking big waterways that are losing federal protections all around the country. And until Congress acts and passes the Clean Water Restoration Act, we're going to have this state under the Clean Water Act, which is in disarray at best and really more close to the mark, where we're actually losing waters from federal protections that will become more polluted and send us back to the days when a majority of our waters weren't safe for fishing, swimming, drinking, and other uses.
So again, you believe that if the Clean Water Restoration Act was passed and that the term navigable waters gets replaced with waters of the United States, that would that eliminate this question of which waters are covered? If it says waters of the United States, will that then make it clear that we're talking about all waters, or will there still be arguments about what's covered, and particularly if something if you can indeed make the argument that something is a small and isolated body, that perhaps it shouldn't be covered?
I think that's a great question. The Clean Water Restoration Act would restore the sort of categorical protections for clean water, for wetlands, streams, including intermittent streams, lakes, natural ponds, and other waters that have been covered by the Clean Water Act for 35 years. That's why the bill goes back to the familiar definition of waters that's in the agency's regulations, because people generally have known what that means. I think it would eliminate 99% of the disputes that we're currently seeing about whether or not things are waters of the U.S. There will always be questions around the edges, David. I think that there's probably no legislation that you can write perfectly that wouldn't, raise some questions. That's kind of why we have courts, to resolve those disputes. I think there probably will still be kinds of cases where, you know, artificial water bodies like those in the Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County case, the ponds were actually originally isolated gravel pits that had filled with water and become an important local habitat for migratory waterfowl. You know, so there might still be questions like that of whether or not Congress intended, you know, all of those to be covered. There are some opponents of the bill that says, oh, this will cover, you know, every drop of water, you know, bird baths, artificial ponds, and that's just not true. I mean, those have never been covered under the old definition. And I, you know, to the extent that there are any disputes like that, people can still raise questions. But we move away from this sort of very upset, unclear, case-by-case situation that we have now that's leaving waters unprotected, going back to a more categorical approach that will be much, much clearer, and I think it would resolve, again, I think, you know, probably 95, 99% of the cases in favor of clean water.
We have maybe a minute or two left. I wonder, I'd just ask you as a general sort of question. We are going to have presidential election here this year, and I think that we already know some of the issues that will be debated. People, no doubt, will be talking about Iraq. We know that they'll be talking about the economy. We know that they'll be talking about health care. I wonder, perhaps with the exception of the implications of global climate change, whether you think that there'll be very much discussion of environmental issues.
Well, I hope that they would be, because, I mean, a lot of surveys show that it is an important, not just the one that we just did, but surveys show that it's important to voters, especially younger voters who are more and more increasingly interested in candidates' positions on environmental issues. And Earth Justice is not one of the environmental groups that gets involved in electoral politics, but surely we would like to see a strong debate on those issues, and I hope that they do get raised. But, you know, based on the last couple of presidential elections, I don't think they're going to get the kind of attention that they should.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're just about at the point where we have to finish up. Any last thing that you would just like to leave with folks before we go?
Well, you know, as someone who works on legislation in Washington, D.C., I see every day the influence that constituents' views have on how members of Congress vote. If people think that it doesn't matter, you know, what they think, that doesn't matter to their members of Congress, they are incorrect. It makes a big difference. And so I would just really strongly urge people who are interested in this issue to learn more Earthjustice.org is one resource. There are many others, many organizations, over 400 organizations around the country supporting this legislation. And to strongly urge your members of Congress, your representatives and senators, especially Congressman Tim Johnson, to support the Restoration Act. It will make a difference.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it with our thanks to our guest, Joan Mulhern. She is Senior Legislative Counsel with Earth Justice. This is a nonprofit public interest law firm interested in environmental issues. They've been around since 1971, initially founded as the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and since 1997 has been known as Earth Justice. And again, if you're interested, as she says, if you're interested in finding out more about this organization, you can go to their website, which is earthjustice.org. Ms. Mulhern, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.